The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Well, I was talking about decorum, you know, and I think Godspell is something that goes against this because it's too light a form for too heavy a content, and I think we got to be very much aware of that. There is something that you can do on this place which you cannot do in another place and the other way around. So I'm very much aware of this. I think it is something that we got to pursue. So maybe just because I do understand all the things so good, maybe I can fiddle around it a bit with myself, and I don't know whether this lecture is the right decorum for this morning to end up my course. So it is maybe too light the content for the heavy form that you ask from me, be a scholar, be somebody who thinks about the most important things in life. Yet, it's interesting to go into jazz, and so why shouldn't we? Jazz, of course, is something that came out of America and has conquered the world. It's one of the most important contributions that America has made to our Western world, for the good and the bad, both. And this lecture originally was made to stand, well, they asked me at a certain conference to speak about jazz in the 20s, and I thought that's very interesting. I have had for many years, and it's everywhere on tape, a lecture on rock music, rock, beat, protest, and revolution. That is the title of that lecture. And this is in a way, and that lecture starts and picks up in the 30s and goes down into in blues and in that in rock and roll and in the Beatles and up to Bob Dylan and so on. I'm not giving that lecture anymore, but I thought it's very interesting to review the previous thing. It might be interesting, just as an aside, to think about yourself when we're doing it. How much of this has influenced us? The things we play, the things we wear, the way we behave, and it is a complete change. And it is not something that the world has done, but of which we have been much a part. And you remember the square that I was drawing the other day, and I said we are just a little bit different, but we are very much the same. So it might be interesting. So to start off, yes, what we're talking about is basically the 20s, the roaring 20s, and this is a very nice little quote that was put out at this conference, which was in St. Albans near London, where I gave that lecture for the first time, and it is on the sheet there. It was the 20s, that was the title of the conference. And the mother says, "Aren't you ashamed of yourself wearing so little clothing to a party?" And the flapper, that's the title for the girls of those age, answers, "Goodness no, mother, if I were ashamed of myself, I wouldn't wear so little clothing to a party." And that's maybe a good introduction to begin with. Another introduction is this long quote, which boy with a beautiful voice and good reading read out of a very important article which was written by Scott Fitzgerald, The Jazz Age. And it is looking back himself on that age. He was an older man. It is written in the 30s, and he looks back to what he called the jazz age, of which he was very much a part. It's not just nostalgia, it's a very intelligent approach to that. And I want to just have now these quotes out of Scott Fitzgerald, The Jazz Age.
It was characteristic of the jazz age that it had no interest in politics at all. It was an age of miracles. It was an age of art. It was an age of excess, and it was an age of satire. We were the most powerful nation. Who could tell us any longer what was fashionable and what was fun? Isolated during the European War, we had begun combing the unknown South and West for folkways and pastimes, and there were more ready to hand. The first social revelation created a sensation out of all proportion to its novelty. As far back as 1915, the unchaperoned young people of the smaller cities had discovered the mobile privacy of that automobile given to young Bill at 16 to make him self-reliant. At first, petting was a desperate adventure, even under such favorable conditions. But presently, confidences were exchanged and the old commandment broke down. As early as 1917, there were references to such sweet and casual dalliance in any number of the Yale Record or the Princeton Tiger. Scarcely had the stater citizens of the Republic caught their breath when the wildest of all generations, the generation which had been adolescent during the confusion of the war, brusquely shouldered my contemporaries out of the way and danced into the limelight. This was the generation whose girls dramatized themselves as flappers, the generation that corrupted its elders and eventually overreached itself less through lack of morals than through lack of taste. By 1923, their elders, tired of watching the carnival with ill-concealed envy, had discovered that young liquor will take the place of young blood, and with a whoop the orgy began. The younger generation was starred no longer. A whole race going hedonistic, deciding on pleasure. The precocious intimacies of the younger generation would have come about with or without prohibition. They were implicit in the attempt to adapt English customs to American conditions. Yes. The word jazz and its progress towards respectability has meant first sex, then dancing, then music. It is associated with a state of nervous stimulation, not unlike that of big cities behind the lines of a war. There were entire classes, people over 50, for example, who spent a whole decade denying its existence, even when its puckish face peered into the family circle. Never did they dream that they had contributed to it. The honest citizens of every class who believed in a strict public morality and were powerful enough to enforce the necessary legislation did not know that they would necessarily be served by criminals and quacks, and do not really believe it today. Rich righteousness had always been able to buy honest and intelligent servants to free the slaves or the Cubans. So when this attempt collapsed, our elders stood firm with all the stubbornness of people involved in a weak case, preserving their righteousness and losing their children. Silver-haired women and men with fine old faces, people who never did a consciously dishonest thing in their lives, still assure each other in the apartment hotels of New York and Boston and Washington that there is a whole generation growing up that will never know the taste of liquor. Meanwhile, their granddaughters pass the well-thumbed copy of Lady Chatterley's Lover around the boarding school, and if they get about at all, know the taste of gin or corn at 16. But the generation who reached maturity between 1875 and 1895 continued to believe what they wanted to believe.
Yes. That's at the drum.
Yes. The people over 30, the people all the way up to 50, had joined the dance. We graybeards, to tread down FPA, remember the uproar when in 1912 grandmothers of 40 tossed away their crutches and took lessons in the tango and the castle walk. A dozen years later, a woman might pack the green hat with her other affairs as she set off for Europe or New York, but Savonarola was too busy flogging dead horses in Augean stables of his own creation to notice. For a while, bootleg Negro records with their phallic euphemisms made everything suggestive, and simultaneously came a wave of erotic plays. Young girls from finishing schools packed the galleries to hear about the romance of being a lesbian, and George Jean Nathan protested. The jazz age had had a wild youth and a heady middle age. There was the phase of the necking parties, the Leopold Loeb murder. I remember the time my wife was arrested on Queensboro Bridge on the suspicion of being the bob-haired bandit, and the John Held clothes. In the second phase, such phenomena as sex and murder became more mature, if much more conventional. Middle age must be served, and pajamas came to the beach to save fat thighs and flabby calves from competition with the one-piece bathing suit. Finally, skirts came down and everything was concealed. Everybody was at scratch now. Let's go. But it was not to be. Somebody had blundered, and the most expensive orgy in history was over. Now once more, the belt is tight, and we summon the proper expression of horror as we look back at our wasted youth. Sometimes, though, there is a ghostly rumble among the drums, an asthmatic whisper in the trombones that swings me back into the early 20s when we drank wood alcohol and every day in every way grew better and better. And there was a first abortive shortening of the skirts, and girls all looked alike in sweater dresses, and people you didn't want to know said, "Yes, we have no bananas." And it seemed only a question of a very few years before the older people would step aside and let the world be run by those who saw things as they were. And it all seems rosy and romantic to us who are young then, because we will never feel quite so intensely about our surroundings anymore.
I got to change the tape, but in the meantime, I think it's very interesting to hear such a man talk about these things like this, because as you have noticed, he talks about the jazz age, the 20s, just like people may talk about our world today. And I think it's one revolution. So in a way, the revolution began in the 18th century, was stopped, or at least put underground, by the Victorian movement. Because if you read about the history of art, then there's much underground of it. The Impressionists, of course, were just a very few guys, and just as a little side, a little rim of the true history of art, but nevertheless we speak about that as the most important thing. That was around the 1880s and 90s, and in that time the revolution came, and now to a much wider public, and not just only the intellectuals, to the front. And it worked itself out, and after the war you have this first very violent experience of it. And the interesting thing is, as he begins, it's not a political revolution, it's a cultural revolution. That means it's not just a change in government, one man chasing out another one, and maybe some new kind of laws or structuring of society involved, but it is the whole way of life that is evolved, that is touched by this. And it's much more important because your life is more important than whether how traffic laws are arranged. So we must understand that was the first. Then the Depression and the Second World War, of course, stopped much of this. And after the Second World War, people took their time to recollect their strength, and it really burst out in the 1960s. And the 1960s are a reprise of the 1920s, but with a much more violent ways, including some bombing and so on. But I don't think they were the very significant things. The significant thing was the total revolution. We call it a sexual revolution. And of course, music, as it had been in the 20s, is very much the centerpiece of it all. So there is a kind of thing which brings these things together. And so it's very good for us to realize what did happen. Now, as I said in another lecture, which I have not given here, revolutions are the sicknesses of mankind. There's something wrong. There's something which has got out of joint. And there's some ideals and the world, and they are different, and then there's a short circuit. And the short circuit, like lightning, is revolution. But in the revolution, there is not anything achieved. But it sometimes is necessarily even, because it frees It makes possible that what is has come in the way of evolution. And so we see that there was a liberation in many ways in this revolution, and that we are happy about that liberation, not because the revolution is so good or its principles are so good, but because it freed and made possible some of the things which we just upheld. As, for instance, the Victorian morals had put women into corsets which were too tight and put them into narrower room, and they were freed and they could ride on a cycle, and so they had to change their clothes. And I think it's fantastic, and we got to be thankful for it. And everybody in this room, just by the simple way he is clothed or she is clothed, testified to the fact that we are all children of that time. Even if we are not a revolutionary people, nevertheless we are happy with some of the fruits of it, which is not the fruit of revolution, but the fruit of an evolution which came in time. So it is a complex phenomenon, but we cannot avoid looking at it, not only for historical interest, not only to understand our own time, because this is part of the prehistory of our own time, but also as something in which we ourselves, in some ways, have been involved, taken some of its effects, and so on. In the 1890s, something which had probably been underground before that time came to the front. It was an age in which we have, of course, symbolist painting and so on, but it was also the first age when people began to dance on black men's music, the cakewalk and things like that. And one of the most famous songs, it's the ditty, it's a popular song. The whole idea of popular songs in the modern sense began in those days, and it is a song which has a double entendre, it has a double meaning. It is, there'll be a hot time in the old town tonight. You can think about a fire, and that's what he always referred to, but that's, of course, half the truth. It is here sung by Bessie Smith later on in the 20s.
And she's all dressed in red. I just hugged and kissed her, and to me then she said, please, oh please, oh do not let me go. You are mine, and I love you best of all. You'll be my man.
In the 19th century, we have had, even since the 30s, minstrelsy, white men making their faces black and sing like the Negroes. They were called coon songs, and this minstrelsy was all over the states. But now the black people themselves took up, and minstrelsy and vaudeville and novelties were coming out very much. And one of the greatest things to come out of that time, and it is, was white, black men's music, was the ragtime, and here you hear 1896 Fun Apps Ragtime Oriole. It's interesting that we listen to a record. And, of course, the invention of the phonograph was very much tied in with these things, just as much as the record is today, very much. And in those days, they didn't have the top 10 charts as they had today, because people were not that organized yet, but in a way it was already there. The very greatest man, and we really got to honor one of the greatest American musicians and composers that was in this area, was Scott Joplin. He came from Missouri, and he wrote his music, was piano music. He looked very high, and the people around him looked very high on to it. It was really meant to be a new way of music, the first black music of America that was meant to be high class. Of course, as you will hear, see presently, people tore it down and turned it into some commercial gimmick and made it low again and brought it into places where it was not meant to be. Nevertheless, to make a long story short, Scott Joplin is a very fine musician, and his Maple Leaf Rag, 1899, was a top hit in his own days. It was danced on, the cakewalk, and of course the cakewalk was a strange, wild, crazy black man's dance, because in respectable circles they were still dancing straight, the kind of dances, the minuets and so on, with violins and that type of things. You didn't dance these wild things that maybe you went to look at it. Maybe the young people, college people, did it downtown in joints where they were not supposed to go. But Scott Joplin's Maple Leaf Rag, 1899, you have here the original racket, which was played on a, if I think I did it, which was played on a piano roll, and so. As you hear it, it's played much slower than you usually hear this, because later on people began to speed it up and make it cheap. This is the way Scott Joplin himself plays it. One word. If you listen to this, you must realize that this music had the same wildness and the same appeal than if you put on the latest, loudest rock music that you can hear today. To these people, it had the same sound. Just put this aside of a nice, vague cathedral or nuage by Debussy. That sounds a little bit different, and this is, so it has that association, but we have gone so much wilder that this has become very beautiful, soft music. Beautiful. This same man was the composer of The Entertainer. Later on, later than this lecture, it was used in that film. And of course, and I think that's the awful thing about it, people call it now The Sting, because a very commercialized, felt cheapened down version of this song, of this music, was used for that film. It is a very beautiful composition. Look at it, listen to it in its original form. This music was not only piano music, although it was composed as piano music, incidentally, very difficult music to play, But it was also turned into music for bands, like brass bands. Here, the record that I'm going to play now is a recording of Peter Bocage's Love Giles Ragtime Band, which was a band playing about 10, 15 years ago in New Orleans. And it still played these things. And they tried here to play it in the original way as it was played way down in the beginning of this century in New Orleans and in many, many other places. Things don't happen in the backwaters of the world in St. Louis or New Orleans or someplace like that. You got to be in New York. And there you had maybe the first very famous, very important musician. His name, interestingly, is Jim Europe. Jim Europe was a musician in an army band. When the war began, one of the generals said to his people, "We got to have the best brass band in the world." And he asked Jim Europe to arrange it. And Jim Europe had many brass bands, and during the war, World War I, these brass bands were all over Europe playing in before their squadrons or whatever you call it, doing all these things that military bands are supposed to do. But also, he had little units out of it playing a new kind of music, the blues, or jazz, if you want to call it. And it was a kind of black music, the blues. Where does it come from? It's very interesting that Handy wrote a book, somebody else wrote a book for him, in the mid-20s. It's called The Blues by Handy, and Handy is called the father of the blues. I used to always to say that he's the stepfather of the blues. And he very unashamedly tells this. He had a band down in 1903 or something, and they were playing somewhere, and the dance, and everybody was stiff bored by this man, playing the violin, playing the old quadrilles and minuets and so on. And then some man in that college dance said, "Why don't we have good music? And don't you play me some ragtime cakewalk?" And they tried. But he said, "That's boring. That's nonsense stuff. It's no good." And he went out in the street and he got some black people and he put them on the stage and he had a great success and he overplayed this whole orchestra. And Handy, being a good man to listen, and a good man to know where his purse was, I thought that's the thing to do. And so he invented the blues, imitating these people. And he made it viable, commercialized it, streamlined it, made it possible. And so the blues age began. And the Handy Blues is, of course, 1912. The Memphis Blues is one of his first compositions. The Memphis Blues, he had quite a time to have it published. But then his fame came and his big money came. And that's the kind of music that Jim Europe and his band were playing. The record that you will hear very soon, it's a record of those days, is the Missouri Blues. This band was very soon asked by a couple that came from England, Vernon and Irene Castle, to play for their establishment. They had made a dancing school. They danced themselves. Irene Castle is said to be a very beautiful woman, and he was a very good dancer, and they made a perfect couple, and they danced a new dance, the Castle Walk and the Foxtrot. They were the first to introduce the Foxtrot, and all the upper 10 was going that. And as it said, and this is a quote out of a paper of the out of that time, it was syncopated music for the 400. That means in the highest circles of New York. These people went there to there. It was in New York, and of course syncopated music meant backbench music. So there you have a black man entertaining or making the music for the white man. It's very interesting, this little quote that came in 1914, because Irene Castle was doing a little bit more than dancing. And she wrote a book in which she gave good advice to women. So 1914, listen, Irene Castle informing women what to do if you want to dance. Don't fasten your blouse down too tightly. And be sure in selecting one of the transparent, flimsy little affairs now so much in vogue for dancing that you can stretch your arms right above your head without difficulty. In speaking of hose, it may not come amiss to say that the new styles of stockings with elastic tops that hold them up snugly with the aid of only a round garter are much better to dance in than the looser hose that requires garters suspended from the corset. Drop the turkey trot, the grizzly bear, the bunny hug. These dances are ugly and graceful, out of fashion. Nowadays, we dance morning, noon, and night. What is more, we are unconsciously, while we dance, warring not only against the natural lines of figures and gowns, but we are warring against fat, against sickness, and against nervous troubles, for we are exercising. We make ourselves lithe and slim and healthy, and these are the things that all the reforms in the world could not do for us. You see, it is the beginning of a revolution also in women clothes. And very soon the women were completely differently clothed. This was the beginning, and it spread all over the world, not just the 400 in New York. It's a new era. Jim, Europe later went to Europe and introduced the music. There are quite a few accounts of this. He had great success there, but we still talking about the older age. Here is Jim Europe, 15 or 16. The wildest music in the world, 1915. The same period, and this is more or less the average in those days, because this type of music very much had a strong influence on popular music of those days. If you really could listen, maybe later on I have one or two of those records, of the popular music of those days, it's so soft, it's so dead, that people were very happy to give it an injection. The sick music got to have a kind of iron pill injection to give it some lifeblood and so on. And of course, the black man's music was asked to do this. This is Ray Miller's Black and White Melody Boys, Make Believe. I think it is. Just listen. This is the average music in pre-1920. Soon we will hear the other kind of the influence of the black man's music on it. This is little bit, well, of course it cannot be without that influence, that's almost impossible, but it's little influence. It's sounds a little bit like Muzak today, and it is of the same family. But now we get the Frisco Jazz Band, 1917. This Frisco Jazz Band, and the word jazz appears over and over again in those days, usually written J-A-S-S, not the Z-Z that comes later. There are many titles with jazz: Jazzbo Jazz, Jazz Deluxe, Johnson's Jazz Blues, and this particular record is called Umbrellas to Mend. And the crazy titles are everywhere. And we must know that in Zurich, way down in Europe, in 1917, there was a new movement, and it is called the Dada Movement. And it's said that they just picked up a dictionary, and they opened it, and they just put it down, and there they had the word Dada, which means in French, hobby horse. And but the Dada Movement is very interesting, that out of the same period in America, and I don't know whether they knew something about it, although Marcel Duchamp, some other early Dada people were in New York, but you have titles like That Dada Strain, and you have Bo La Bo, and Shimmy Shama Wobble, and so on. These are all kind of titles that exactly belong to the same kind of strain of a kind of absurdity, and the same kind of anti-cultural trend. You don't write sonatas, you write the Shimmy Shama Wobble, you see, or the Dada Strain. In 1918, the great thing happened. The Tiger Act was introduced by the original Dixieland Jazz Band. They were playing in New York, and everybody went to listen to that wild music. And he asked his people, how do you do it? And out of what I would call the Rousseauistic mentality, these people began to talk like this. Why I'm saying Rousseauistic? Because Jean-Jacques Rousseau has said, all civilization is just a little something outside. The real thing is inside. We got to get rid of all these layers of culture in order to have the real thing. And now this was really coming through. The revolution that was begun by Rousseau now really takes, really fully place. And so these people said, how do you play it? They said, oh, we just pick up our carriage and there we go. We improvise. But don't you read music? Oh, we never learn to read music. Of course, all these boys went to conservatories and knew perfectly to read the music, and they were only able to play this music because they had been playing for 10 years together, and it was all rehearsed from the first to the last note, and otherwise you can never make it. But they said, oh, it's just bursting out, we let ourselves go, it's improvised, we don't know anything, and every time again, when people tell you, oh, you know that black musician or that white musician, he just plays like this, he doesn't know a note, you know that you're really fooled, because of course he knows this note. There's no musician in the world that doesn't. And so these people just told so. It was novelty. It was a kind of barn and hokum. That's what made music. And of course, they danced on it. It's a nice little a quote out of something in that time. It was a shift in dancing away from gentility, ballroom decorum. There you have the beautiful word I was talking about this morning. The ballroom decorum, elegance of motion to a franker, jerkier, faster, and snappier kind of dance. Faster, snappier, jerkier kind of dance. It was franker. It was something like this. Tiger Rag, 1918, the original Dixieland Jazz Band. and just compare it with the next one. That was the average band of the day, Jerkes Novelty Band, 1920. We can understand the young people of those days that they ran to the record shop to buy the Tiger Rag. 5th of January 1921, 55 years ago. That was a fantastic, important day because then for the first time a blues was recorded in because now we enter in the blues age. Of course, we have the prehistory of the handy blues, but now we get these many, many female singers who were singing the blues. Here you have Mary Stafford with her jazz band, Johnny Dunn might be in it, playing the Royal Garden Blues. It is still halfway a blues. It's a kind of jazzy blues. It's a kind of adaptation. But, for instance, in 1922, there was a blues contest where there was black public and also white public. So the upper ten was there, and the black public, and they were singing. They had two different people like Bessie Smith and Mamie Smith and some other Smiths and people. And, well, the mayor of New York was there. It was a fantastic occasion. So this is the things that happened. Mary Stafford's Royal Garden Blues. It starts, if you just listen very carefully, it says, everybody starts jazzing around. And it's just a little, my fine illustration of what Scott Fitzgerald was talking about. Everybody starts jazzing around. The public, and maybe particularly the American public, always wants to have second-rate things, those things that are derived. So it took quite a time before the original was ever there, and of course the original was very popular, but only with the black public. The white people listened to things like this. So the black public, of course the blues was already down there. Ma Rainey sang the blues already in the beginning of our century, and she toured the South, and she was the most famous person in the world in the black community. Her pupil and follower was Bessie Smith. I personally think Ma Rainey is better, but she was never really good and recorded in a fine way. Bessie Smith was. She was brought up to Columbia, and she had the finest recordings made. Here you have the very first recording of that great American singer, Bessie Smith, in the beginnings of 1923. Took a few years.
Love you.
I would love to talk about the blues more. They don't have time for it. Just a little key to understand it. You study it for yourself. The blues is just like those things that we talk about when we talked about Rubens. He said you can listen to the, and I just translated, you can listen to the sound, you can listen to the music, you can understand the imagery, and you can go into the depth of what it really means and go back, way back to the deep human content. All these layers and layers of content. Now, on surface, this music, which is not that wild, really talks about relationships of men and women. Usually, it's a very peculiar kind of song. It's very different from the Western tradition. Western tradition are always courting songs. We sing about the woman that we may have. So Schubert has the songs about die schöne Müllerin, the beautiful milliner's daughter, and he wants to have her. And he sings how beautiful she is. That's the Western way. It goes way back in the Middle Ages. The Black Man's Song is completely different. It talks about 20 years later when the beloved one is gone. But interestingly, it's always the beloved one. So the man that wretched my life, just to quote the song we just heard, that's the one, it's not talked out of hatred, but of love. And so the song is about the sorrow of the one that's left behind. Now I think if you go one layer deeper, and that this is the real meaning, that the black man is singing about his relationship to the white man. He loves the white man, but he's rejected. And that's a very deep content of these songs. It is talking about race relationships, about wanting to be accepted and then being rejected. But the interesting thing is, and I think it's really a Christian heritage there, that it is a song of love. Later on, when you get these violent black movements, they don't sing the blues anymore. The black man was always misused. And so we heard the original Dixieland jazz band, that they were very popular, but these people didn't tell their public that they all learned it down in New Orleans and they learned it from the black man. Nevertheless, the black people were also up in the world. And so you have, coming from New Orleans during the First World War, quite a few New Orleans musicians, and they worked mainly, and that was the center, in Chicago. And so you have here the greatest jazz band that ever was, I think that is not contested yet, the greatest jazz band that ever was is King Oliver's original Creole jazz band. It played in Chicago. It uses different things which are very typical to the black man, to his kind of music, maybe something that of Africa has to do with it, but it means it is a new way of expressing, not looking for beautiful sounds, but looking for expressive sounds, and so using mutes and all kinds of things in your trumpets. Of course, they were playing in Chicago's South Side, and the greatest musicians there were Oliver himself, who were, incidentally, much later in the 30s, when he had a very rough time because he couldn't get his band together and he couldn't make his money by playing, in the middle 30s he wrote a number of letters to his sister, And these letters are preserved, and they are the most moving letters of a Christian. He says, don't worry, the Lord will take care of me. And even if I die, don't worry. So this man who came, and many of these people came from Christian backgrounds, and they were not anti-Christian. And if we think about a man like King Oliver, he's not a wild junkie or anything like that. He was a real sedate middle-class man. There was only one drinker really in the band, and everybody tried to stop him drinking. That was the drummer. But everybody else was really sober. That doesn't mean that they never touched some whiskey, but they were not really just wild drinkers. And they were, in a way, that iron pill that I was talking about, the iron pill to revive music. So in the audience, there were many, many young white people just to listen to this most fantastic of all musics. And of course, there are two things that happened. By the way, just in between, who was it? Mil O, who was there, and he listened to it. And when he came back to Europe, he made the creation, that's, I think it's called. And that's just an adaptation of King Oliver's music. It is, somebody once told me that he heard the original record and the direction of the man, the composer himself, that it's just King Oliver what you hear. Later on you get other performances and then people don't understand. But it had a wide influence in many ways, but certainly on the young people. And they listened to it in their own framework. And that was a wide framework. And so they listened to it, and it was a strong rhythm. What is the strong rhythm but the heartbeat of life itself? It is man stripped bare of all his civilization, because rhythm means Africa, means prehistory, before history ever began. Of course, this is all cultural superstition. This is all wrong interpretation, but this is how they listened to it. And therefore, this rhythm was for them the most original expression of man himself. These people were, of course, they played exactly within very strict frameworks. You cannot make music like this without a strict framework, but to them, it was just music that plays like that. And the definition had come that jazz music is improvised. They would never have said that, but it was the interpretation. And very soon, you can get the type of jazz, you will hear some of it later, which was rhythm plus improvisation. And that has become modern jazz. But that's not the jazz as these people conceived it of. I think, and I've not the time to go into that, that this music in its structure, it's polyphonic, very different from its own time, its polyphony, that this time music has very much kinship with the music of John Sebastian Bach. And if you listen to the rhythm, you think of the basso continuo, because Bach has it too. It's the same thing, and it's not what people have made of it. But it was the iron pill. Why? I just tried to say that in my lecture on gospel music, because these people never entered the Western culture in the sense of the Enlightenment, just because they were not educated people. So you get, in a way, pre-Enlightenment music. That's why you're so near to Bach.